National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
Today on Groundwire,
there's, you know, really strong moves by corporations to try and move in.
The government of Canada, in the loudest and clearest possible terms, has to unequivocally condemn the imprisonment of Mohamed Fahmy, Peter Greston, everybody else.
It's going to be making migrant workers' lives a bit more difficult than it is, more precarious than it is.
It really started to coalesce, and now it's become this kind of amorphous, misogynistic subculture on the internet.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. This is Emily Stewart.
And I'm Julian Uzielli.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This week, Groundwire was produced at CHRW in London, Ontario. Coming up, voices from the BC teachers' strike, Toronto World Pride, and we learn about the conditions three jailed Al Jazeera journalists may be facing in Egypt from someone who knows the prison firsthand.
As well as a community radio report from Powell River, British Columbia, where CJMP has hired a new First Nations language programming coordinator.
That's all coming up on this edition of Groundwire, but first, here are the headlines.
Mina Ramos of CFRU in Guelph, Ontario, brings us the following report. On Wednesday, June 25th, members of the migrant justice group No One Is Illegal confronted Jason Kenney, Canada's Minister of Employment and Social Development, in the closing moments of a one-day skills summit sponsored by the Conservative government. While Kenney spoke of the need for Canada to acquire more skilled workers, organizers from No One Is Illegal drew attention to the drastic effects of his recent moratorium on temporary foreign workers in the restaurant sector and his changes to the Live-In Caregiver Program. Tings Chak of No One Is Illegal Toronto spoke to CFRU on her reasons for disrupting the summit.
We only got wind of this happening 2 or 3 hours before it actually happened, so it was like a very quick mobilization attempt. I mean, it's coming off the heels after a week of the announcements to changes to the temporary foreign worker program. And I guess some of the highlights of that specifically is that it's going to be making migrant workers' lives a bit more difficult than it is, more precarious than it is. It's going to be more difficult to change jobs. It ties them to employers, and it also denies them, you know, permanent immigration status, which is something that No One Is Illegal Toronto, as well as lots of migrant justice groups, have been calling for a very long time. And so the recent changes we've been calling is really a mass deportation order to all those tens of thousands of people that will be affected. And it was also coming at the same day that Kenney was also making changes similarly to the Live-In Caregiver Program. So we heard that he was going to be at this fancy hotel in downtown Toronto presenting on sort of, I guess, skills summit, which is probably a euphemism for, like, how can we bring in more migrant workers, exploit them, but also frame it in a way of, like, you know, job shortage for real Canadians, that kind of thing. So we just went in, and surprisingly, we were able to get through, you know, his very substantial security kind of personnel, and went in and just sort of disrupted it. And he's gotten used to disruptions. I think, in fact, in Vancouver, he had been disrupted so many times in past years that I think he had made some sort of vow not to do press conferences there anymore. So he's used to it. You could tell that he was a little bit flustered, and you know that there's going to be some real talking to the security staff after the event, but I think it is an important moment to be doing that.
The following headline comes from Courtney Harab of CJMP in Powell River, British Columbia.
The Chilcotin First Nation is celebrating the unanimous decision from the Supreme Court of Canada, granting them title to over 1,700 kilometers of their traditional lands in British Columbia. This ends 30 years of court battle between the Chilcotin and the BC government. This decision could set a precedent for hundreds of unresolved land claims. There are several proposed pipeline routes for unceded land in BC. What this will mean for future pipeline development still remains to be seen, but this could strengthen the ability of First Nations to preserve their traditional territories not only in BC, but across Canada.
The next headline is from Catherine Fisher of CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia.
On July 4th, BC Yukon Association of Drug War Survivors, supported by the Pivot Legal Society and on behalf of homeless citizens of Abbotsford, BC, argued in BC Supreme Court that Abbotsford City bylaws preventing access to safe shelter are unconstitutional. The case seeks to recognize access to safe shelters as a basic human right in Abbotsford, a community of about 130,000 people located in the Fraser Valley and the Greater Vancouver area. Current Abbotsford bylaws prohibit anyone from being present in any park overnight, erecting a basic survival structure, or even sleeping in a car. Figures released by the Fraser Valley Homeless Count show the number of homeless people in the city's increased by almost one-third since 2011. The report also indicates that 75% of homeless people in Abbotsford are unhoused. Pivot lawyer DJ Larkin says that Abbotsford bylaws criminalize people that sleep outside, essentially making homelessness illegal. This case draws on the Adams decision of 2008, where the BC Supreme Court held that Victoria BC bylaws prohibiting homeless people from erecting shelters in a city park violated charter rights and was unconstitutional. Abbotsford treatment of its homeless citizens has been in the public eye in the past. In 2013, city staff admitted to dumping chicken manure to deter homeless people from living along Gladys Avenue, which is across the street from the only adult emergency shelter in Abbotsford. In 2014, mayor and council voted against a limited bylaw amendment that would have allowed the development of a low-barrier housing project, which the province had offered to mostly fund, citing concerns from business owners that it would attract homeless people into their downtown. The city is seeking to strike down the lawsuit. Doug Smith, a member of the BC Yukon Association of Drug War Survivors, says that the city should be taking steps to fight homelessness instead of fighting people without homes. A verdict in the case is expected after July 14th. Catherine Fisher, Groundwire.
Groundwire will celebrate Pride festivals across Canada this summer with stories from our country's diverse LGBTQ communities. Ed Von Attercast from CHRW has more on Toronto World Pride.
At the end of June, the city of Toronto played host to World Pride. The streets of downtown Hogtown were taken over by throngs of lesbian, gay, transgendered, bisexual, asexual, and two-spirited people from all over the globe, enjoying the World Pride celebrations. According to some numbers, as many as 1,200 people took part in the World Pride Parade on Sunday alone, as well as thousands for the annual Dyke March. The World Pride Parade featured 248 floats and lasted nearly 5 hours. We caught up with some people attending the Pride celebrations.
Got to the streets 10 minutes ago, so far, awesome. Great that people are coming to Toronto and it takes away from Rob Ford. Now we've got something that's actually we're proud of.
I think we're really fortunate to be living in Canada where we can be ourselves and be open about who we are and be together. So it's great that we're able to host the world and we're excited to be here for World Pride. Like, we haven't come for a few years, but we thought we couldn't miss this year because it's the first time we're sponsoring it internationally.
For Groundwire, I'm Ed Von Attercast.
Tune in throughout the summer for stories from Pride Weeks across Canada.
A Canadian who was imprisoned in Egypt last summer says his country should take a stronger stance against the recent sentencing of Canadian journalist Mohamed Fahmy in Egypt.
Fahmy was one of the three Al Jazeera journalists sentenced to 7 years in prison for the charges of spreading false news and aiding the Muslim Brotherhood. Many media organizations across the world have protested this ruling, calling it a miscarriage of justice and attack on freedom of the press.
Last summer, Canadians Tarek Loubani and John Grayson stopped in Cairo, Egypt, on their way to Gaza for a humanitarian mission. They got caught up in a violent protest and were arrested and held without charges for 50 days. Now, another Canadian, Al Jazeera's Mohamed Fahmy, is in prison in Egypt. Fahmy was recently sentenced to 7 years in prison on terrorism charges, along with two other journalists from Al Jazeera English. Critics called their trial a farce, and the leaders of the United States, the UK, and Australia have loudly condemned the sentencing. But Canada's government has stayed relatively quiet. Tarek Loubani lives in London, Ontario. CHRW spoke with Loubani about his reaction to Fahmy's sentencing.
The government of Canada, in the loudest and clearest possible terms, has to unequivocally condemn the imprisonment of Mohamed Fahmy, Peter Greston, everybody else. He is a Canadian citizen, and there is no but after that. And so they must be speaking loudly for his release.
Fahmy and the others are being held in Tora Prison, the same prison where Loubani and Grayson were held last year.
They're actually in the same cell block that we were in, possibly and probably in the same room we were in, because really there was only one political room in that particular cell block. And so I can tell you what it looked like. It was a very small room, which had way too many people. And when we say small, we mean 3 meters by 3 meters. When we say too many people, we mean 10 or more people. And cockroaches everywhere, where there's nothing protecting them from the elements. If it's cold outside, it's cold inside. Daily, they would be in that prison cell for a minimum of 23 hours.
So far, Egypt has defied international pressure to release the journalists. Groundwire will observe a moment of silence in solidarity with the imprisoned journalists. That's all for headlines. You can visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca. We'll be right back after That's Okay by Roland Prevost. City is falling down onto the streets below. You never loved me. Sands of time will let you go. We played with fire. Later on, we played with ice. But now I'm tired with this game of roller dice. But that's okay, love. Nothing's ever meant to last. Unless it's true love. But lately, I don't have.
That was That's Okay by Roland Prevost, off of his album One in Breath. Welcome back to Groundwire, National Community Radio News from the National Campus and Community Radio Association, and now for our feature stories.
BC teachers are still on strike, and now summer school in that province is canceled after the first mediation attempts between the BC Teachers Federation and provincial government failed. The Teachers Federation wants the province to address learning and working conditions. CJSF Burnaby and CITR Vancouver spoke to local academics and activists on the latest strike developments.
On July 2nd, Jim Eicher, president of the British Columbia Teachers Federation, released a statement that mediation between the BCTF and the BC Public School Employers Association was currently impossible. The strike continues and summer school is currently cancelled. At this time, the BC Liberal government has twice been found by the courts to have violated teachers' constitutional rights in their move to restrict the union's ability to negotiate on issues such as class size and composition. The 2011 BC Supreme Court ruling on this issue is being appealed by the BC government. We asked Dan Leitch, SFU Education Associate Professor and researcher in education policy and practice, to expand on the history and current state of these issues.
Since the early 2000s, government has legislated contracts, has changed contracts outside of the collective agreement. The Supreme Court of British Columbia has ruled that that was done illegally. What's interesting, if you look at the current situation, you have the Labor Relations Board ruling that government can selectively lock teachers out of the workday. At the same time, you have the Labor Relations Board ruling that government can also selectively require essential services from teachers. So the ability of teachers to actually engage in effective resistance and effective collective action is relatively constrained. We have both the teachers and the government working from different foundations. So the teachers are working from the foundation of that case has been decided, and one of the remedies in that case was to return the class size and composition limits to the collective agreement. However, government has appealed the decision, so government's working as if those provisions have not been returned to the collective agreement. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be resolved until the appeal is heard. As far as we can tell, that will be this fall.
You can listen to CJSF's full interview with Dan Leitch on CJSF.ca's featured programming.
Former Vancouver School Board trustee and education activist Jane Bowie spoke to CITR's The City on the current negotiating environment, the current and potential consequences in a continuing lack of funding for public education, and the claim that salary increase demands by the BCTF are out of line with the public sector.
I guess as a former trustee, someone that's been active in fighting for public education for a couple of decades now here in the province, is the fact that I think that we have a provincial government that is intent on systematically undermining the public confidence in public education. I think that's important for the public to understand that years ago, teachers chose to fight for learning conditions in terms of class size and composition and put that ahead of salary demands. Those were reflected in the contracts that the provincial government tore up, as the courts determined later, illegally. And so now teachers are in this spot where not only are the issues of the learning conditions not dealt with, not protected, you also have them, you know, way behind in terms of salary. And part of the impact, not just here, but, you know, it's a global thing, of defunding public education is that in order for it to continue, school districts, individual schools, individual teachers are being forced to look elsewhere for the resources to be able to continue to provide the education that the children deserve. There's, you know, really strong moves by corporations to try and move in. The most recent one that's gotten a fair amount of coverage has been Chevron's refueling education program, which is a North American program which teachers apply for a grant to Chevron itself approves to fund various projects in their schools. In 2005, after years of grassroots organizing and the election of a really strong vocal COPE board, the two things combined, the province actually increased funding, and Vancouver, it's the one year in the last 15 years where they didn't have to be cut. There was $6 million extra funding in Vancouver, but right across the province. So I was just out on the picket line in solidarity with the teachers, and people were just uniformly supportive. The level of support, public support out there for the teachers is extraordinary, and I think it's public support for public education itself. People understand what's at stake.
Listen to the full interview with Jane Brewery on thecity.fm. This has been Megan Thomas reporting from CJSF Burnaby.
We'll be right back after Sheltered by Metro 4. In this next feature, the hosts of Femisphere on CKUW, Angie St. Mars and Jen Unwin, interview Chicago-based feminist activist David Futrell. Femisphere is produced and hosted by Jen, Angie, and Anna Sigrither from CKUW in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Futrell writes the well-known blog We Hunted the Mammoth, where he roots out the truth behind the men's rights movement and exposes the inherent misogyny of many groups. Femisphere sat down with Futrell to talk about the new federal charity status granted to the Canadian men's rights organization, CAFE.
And joining us on the phone is David Futrell. Describe to us, if you wouldn't mind, sort of an overview of what your blog's all about and why you're doing it.
Basically, the blog, it sort of started out as a way to kind of chronicle the men's rights movement, which, you know, I discovered about a little over 4 years ago and just found them kind of endlessly fascinating and frustrating. And so I started the blog to kind of try to rebut some of their sillier arguments. But as I sort of ventured into it more and more, I was actually rather surprised and stunned by the amount of just pure, unadulterated misogyny there was in the men's rights movement.
I guess we should maybe explain to our listeners who aren't familiar with what the men's rights movement or men's rights associations are about, kind of where they started and why they seem to be gaining in popularity, if not understanding.
Well, I think essentially they've grown out of a backlash against feminism, but it wasn't really until the 90s that that basically the current men's rights ideology kind of took form. A guy named Warren Farrell wrote a book called The Myth of Male Power.
Right.
And essentially the whole point of the book is to kind of upend everyone's perceptions of who the real victims in society are. And he sort of set forth this idea that, you know, men essentially have a much, much greater responsibilities than women, and that they end up being disposable men, disposable males. And essentially what's happened is that the men's rights movement as we know it now started coalescing online in the 90s in Usenet groups, and then later moved to the web, and essentially started coming together about four or five years ago. It really started to coalesce, and now it's become this kind of amorphous, misogynistic subculture on the internet.
So, as you're probably aware, the Canadian Association for Equality, which is CAF, has just recently received a charity status from the federal government here in Canada.
Yeah, the idea that one of these organizations could be considered a legitimate charity is a little bizarre, and you wonder if the people making that decision really knew what they were dealing with. Certainly, our organization, CAF or CAFE, has been involved with groups that are very hateful. They promoted themselves in deceptive ways and so on. They tried to set up a what they called an Equality Day outdoor concert recently.
Right.
And essentially, as soon as their sponsors and the bands in this concert found out actually what the group was about, they backed off in an instant. And it's striking that here's a group that's now recognized as a charity, but they can't set up a concert without essentially misleading the people into it.
Apparently the federal government granted that charity status because they found that the group was providing a beneficial service for men. That was kind of the reasoning behind the granting of the charity status.
Well, it's a group that did raise a significant amount of money that they say is going to go towards some kind of, I believe, like a storefront center for men of some kind. And so I think that someone might look at that and go, okay, they're actually trying to provide something. And that's actually rare among men's rights activists. So there's, you know, that they actually might set up something that might actually serve some men. I mean, the logic is not completely wrong on the part of the people who granted them that status. I just, from my experience with men's rights activists in general, and from what I've seen from that group and the way that it's worked in concert and with A Voice for Men and other, hateful groups.
Yeah.
I'll believe it when I see it, I guess.
So I just wonder, you're doing it full time here. You're basically calling out this behavior and saying this is unacceptable. And I'm just wondering if you've got any words of wisdom for our listeners.
I think you can get guys to understand some of these issues by trying to get them to feel a certain degree of empathy with women and put themselves in the shoes of women.
Thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks again for having me.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Devin Piel is the new First Nations Language Coordinator at CJMP in Powell River, British Columbia, where she's broadcasting the Tla'amin language. Rachel Swatek, the NCRA's Groundwire Coordinator, spoke with Piel about her community radio plans.
If you could start off, could you just let me know about how you got involved with CJMP?
Well, Zoe from CJMP and Courtney approached me and my friend Shelby and asked us to work on the Reasonating Reconciliation Project. So we did a radio documentary on residential school and how it impacted language in our community.
Mm-hmm. And from that point on, were you just kind of hooked with working in radio?
Yeah, totally. I loved it and I learned so much from CJMP through that project, and I wanted to keep working with them after that.
Can you tell me about the work you're going to be doing with them in coming months?
Well, my title is First Nations Language Coordinator, so I will be sharing Tsleil-Waututh legends and teachings and language on air in short little segments that will be plugged in throughout the day. So right now I'm working on 4 legends from our community that I got off old VHS tapes. And I'm going to be playing them, the elders speaking in the language, and then we're going to kind of do a radio play in English after.
Okay. Are there a lot of people in the community who speak the language?
There's different levels of speakers. We don't have a lot of fluent speakers anymore. A lot of them have passed on. But for, like, the generation that are under elders, there are speakers, but like I said, not everybody is fluent anymore.
How did you get involved with learning Tsleil-Waututh?
Well, it was offered to me when I was in school, and then after that, we record our language in something called orthography, which is different symbols in addition to the regular phonetics. And because I learned the orthography in school, someone in Tsleil-Waututh approached me and asked me to work with First Voices, which is an online resource that my community can log on to and learn the language from there. So I've been pretty involved for quite a while now, actually.
Have you noticed a growth of language speakers in the community as websites like First Voices have become more popular?
Yeah, a little bit. My brother, who's younger than me, is a better speaker than I am now because of First Voices.
So now, what is it, do you think, about radio that makes it something that is really great for sharing languages, or what makes you want to share your language through radio?
As a First Nations person, like, my culture is very oral. Everything's passed down, so I think that's why radio is so appealing to me, because it's all oral, right? And it's all listening, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what do you hope will come out of the work that you do with CJMP and the stories that you share on the air?
I hope that my greater community of Palaver can keep learning about my people, and that everyone from my reserve also can be reminded of our old teachings and legends, and we can become more proud of who we are.
How long will you be working with them?
I have a 1-year contract right now under the grant.
Do you hope to continue working in radio after that?
Oh, definitely. I didn't think that I would ever be involved in media, but I'm super happy that I am. And yeah, after that radio documentary, it's called We Are Still Here, it kind of just opened a lot of doors for me and opened my eyes, and I'm very happy with where I am right now.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for calling.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire. From CHRW in London, Ontario, thanks for tuning in. I'm Julian Uzielli.
And I'm Emily Stewart. Music this week was by Roland Prevost and Metro 4. We thank contributors Mina Ramos, Courtney Harab, Catherine Fisher, Ed Von Attercast, Angie St. Mars, Jen Unwin, and Rachel Swatek. We also thank Devin Piel and the cast and crew of Groundwire.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download this and past episodes at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.